Daddy, what are you doing?
I'm doing a podcast, Dizzy.
Hello and welcome to the Too Cool for School podcast. I'm your host, Yannick, and on today's episode, we are talking about parenting and advocacy in the SEND community. So I've got an amazing guest with me today, and I will allow her to introduce herself.
Hi everyone, my name is Tinaka. I am a mum of two. I'm a purpose-led entrepreneur and I'm also a mum to an autistic child who is 8 years old.
Okay, great stuff. So to kick us off and just starting with like your parenting journey, when was the moment that you felt or had any indication that your son?
Mm-hmm.
That your son may have needs, like you may not have known what needs they were, but you thought, actually, do you know what, he might have needs. Like, when was that moment for you?
I think it was when he was around 1.5. Because of what I run, which is Mums in Tea, that's like a social platform for mums to connect both on and offline. So we were doing a lot of face-to-face events. This was pre-pandemic. So we're doing so many different face-to-face events. And I was exposed to seeing a lot of other people's children. We wasn't just at home in a bubble. We were out. Me and Ez were out. Yeah. And I guess it's two things, actually. So before I get into that, like, I didn't feel comfortable taking him to nursery at around 1 when work was like, okay, are you coming back? And I was like, not too sure. I guess I just had the gut feeling that, like, I don't know if I want to do it just yet. Like, yeah. I'm not sure. This is more than, oh, I'm going to miss him. I just felt like he's not ready. And then, yeah, I guess coupled with the fact that I was seeing other children and realising, oh, okay, Ez isn't quite talking yet. And he's just a little bit different. I didn't know exactly what it was, but I just went to speech and language and was like, oh, like, I think he's meant to be saying a few things and he's not right now. So, yeah, it was from there. We kind of went down that pathway of like getting him assessed. But yeah, it was around 1.5 that I was like, might be a little bit different.
Yeah. And how did you access like speech and language? So for those who are listening who maybe have little ones and think, actually, do you know what? Like, sounds a bit like my son or daughter. Mm-hmm. How did they access speech and language?
I Googled the nearest speech and language drop-in center.
Yeah.
So I think I was quite adamant on making sure that we used as many services as possible because, I didn't go back to work until he was like 18 months. And so I had to use all the resources around me. So like we were outside. So we would go to like the children's centres and they had like all of the different things that they offered, and speech and language drop-in was one of them. So I just Googled what the nearest one to me was because they didn't have one in the children's centre I went to. I had to go to, but this was all pre-pandemic. I'm not sure what it's like now, but I can't imagine it's changed that much, you know? So yeah, I went to speech and language. I was like, hey, he's not talking. And then they referred us to actual speech and language. And then we had a few sessions, again, pre-pandemic. Then she, I think we had like 5 sessions, and I made really good friends with her, but I actually still talk to her, the therapist. She was an Asian lady and she just got it. Like, she was just like telling me about what her life was like as, you know, a speech and language therapist who's from the Black and brown community. Yeah. And what the disparities that she was seeing in terms of speech and language therapy is mostly white middle class women who work there, but the children that come through, especially in that area, it was not that. So yeah, we were just talking about that experience and stuff like that. And yeah, it was through there that I got referred to a pediatrician because she signed Ezekiel off with social communication disorder. Is it disorder? Social communication. Yeah. So social communication disorder or delay or something.
Yeah.
And then the pandemic hit.
Oof.
Yeah. I'd seen a pediatrician on Zoom twice and she was collecting all the information about Ayres, and then she spoke to the nursery, spoke to the family, just trying to get as much information about Ezekiel. And then the second time she met him, she was like, oh, I can't say for sure because I've not met him in person, but I think he might need a diagnosis. And then I was just like, oh, okay. I didn't, because it was just the path that we was going on.
Of course.
I didn't think anything of it until, you know, I think this was like maybe a year and a half later or about a year later, pandemic at the times. We saw her in person and she diagnosed him there and then.
Yeah.
That he is autistic. So it was kind of like, yeah, it was kind of like a crazy journey. But yeah, from speech and language to a pediatrician, that's how we got our diagnosis.
And how was it for you, like as parents, sort of getting that diagnosis? And let's focus not necessarily in terms of like how you felt in that moment, because obviously every parent's feeling will be different. You know, finding out their child has a diagnosis of any condition, but more so, what are some of the misconceptions that you had to sort of maybe unlearn about like SEND or autism from like your experiences, like just growing up or in school?
Mm-hmm. I didn't know much about autism. I'll be completely honest. I had to really hyper-focus and try to learn as much as possible about what it is. And I guess our family's reactions gave me an idea of what was to come, if that makes sense, in terms of just other people's reactions. I had to do a lot of unlearning. I had certain preconceptions about autism, and when I found out about the diagnosis initially, I was like, oh yeah, cool, because we were kind of expecting it. But then the reality set in and I was like, oh, okay, like, is he ever going to talk? You know, is he ever going to love? Is he ever going to... Will he be able to get through school? Will he get a job? You know, I just had no idea what that was going to look like in the future for him. But then also I was reading about like early intervention, which I feel like we did a lot of in the early days. And early intervention is the best predictor of like, you know, how your child will turn out in terms of, you know, their outcomes, like all of these things that I've mentioned, like speech and language and all of this kind of stuff. If you are doing early interventions, like from 0 to 5, then they have the best chances. So I guess it was dealing with the cultural side of it, the stigma and all of it, as well as actually, no, I need to get the best support for my child to make sure that like this doesn't hold him back. It doesn't need to hold him back because it's just a difference in the way his brain is wired as opposed to being defaulted. And I had to really, I had to unlearn a lot of things.
Yeah, that's very important, and thank you for sharing, especially in regards to the cultural stigma, because especially in the role that I do, you know, I work multi-agency with, you know, CAMS, clinicians, etc. And that's still an issue even until now.
Oh, yeah.
You know, some
it's
families
rife.
That, you know, I work with, and depending on the culture, many from, you know, our communities, like African or Caribbean communities, they don't want to engage with assessment, you know, nothing like that. Even if there are indications that their, you know, child may have needs. So not to reflect necessarily on the reaction from your family, but what do you think like families sort of need to be mindful of in terms of like tackling that sort of news for a child, so the child is getting the right support? And the second part, which, you know, I can follow up again, is what do you think like clinicians and health services need to be mindful of when trying to engage those communities? Because if we look at the representation or the demographic of those clinicians, a lot of them are going to be like white, you know, middle class or whatever, and they engage in communities that are not theirs. So twofold question, thinking about the family and how families can support in regards to their actions, and what clinicians and like healthcare services need to be mindful of when thinking about, okay, how do we support that family?
I'm going to say something that might sound a bit harsh with regards to families.
Mm-hmm.
Your child comes first.
Yeah.
Your child comes first.
Yeah.
Literally, your child comes first. Forget all of that. Easier said than done, I know. Forget all of the, oh, what are people going to think? Then the people are not in your house with you when your child is melting down and you don't know what to do. When your child is having issues with routines and you don't know what to do. All these external voices are not present with you in your house. They're not there raising your child with you. So I very much have the... I feel for a lot of families that don't get it, but also I'm like, there's so much help and so much support that you still need to fight for, even when you are on board, right? So many waiting lists, so many things that world is just, it can be quite draining because everything is a fight. So you're already fighting internally with yourself and then you're now coming to fight the system. Get rid of it. Make your life easier and put your child first. If your child needs support, and again, if they understand the implications, well, not even implications, if they understand the benefits of early intervention and how much it can make a big, big difference, they'll get rid of that stigma very, very quickly and just dive in and get the help that they need. But also, what happens if you don't? So we have to look at the prison system and the people on the other side. I remember I have a friend who works in public health and she told me some stats. I can't remember them off my head, but she was talking about the amount of black men that are in the prison system who have undiagnosed ADHD and autism, and how if they would have just got support in school, if they just had families that recognized it, that supported them and helped them and fight for them and advocate for them, they probably wouldn't end up where they were. So as much as, now accept it because it makes your life easier now, what about that child in 15, 20 years time? They're not going to stay children forever. Do you know what I mean? So I feel like if families were just a bit more for the now thinking, but also forward thinking, we'd probably have a bit more uptake on that. I think it's a little bit selfish, if I'm honest. It's a little bit selfish if you don't get support for your child because of you're scared of what people are going to think. It's selfish. It's not about the child at that point. And no, it's not fair. Important.
Yeah, that's important. And in terms of like clinicians and like healthcare practitioners coming in to support those families with like cultural stigma. Do you think that there needs to be like an intentionality to say, you know what, I might have to work different with this group? Or do you think it needs to be actually like the care is, you know, one size fits all?
It's not one size fits all. That's what I was literally just about to say. It's not one size fits all. They have to take into account religion. They have to take into account just even some languages just don't even have the words for ADHD, autism. They don't have the actual language for it. So the understanding of it is very, very minimal. So it's coming in and knowing that, okay, this is potentially the baseline that I'm working with. How can I help this family to understand that the child needs help? And I feel like it's a tough job. But if you've committed yourself to saying, yeah, I want to be a speech and language therapist, I want to, you know, work in this field, then it's part of your job to make sure that the clients that you're working with or the patients that you're working with get supported to the best of your ability. So I think it's twofold, you know, it's difficult on both sides because if you've got resistance from this, from the families, and then you also have like health professionals who maybe don't know how to engage or don't, you know, just do a one size fits all approach, then you're going to have a generation of lost children.
Yeah. No, thank you for sharing. Yeah. That's great insight. And So sort of moving forward a bit, like you've, you know, seen the speech and language pathologies, you've been to pediatricians, you've got the diagnosis, and now Ez is getting ready for school. Like, how was the transition into, you know, into school? Like, what was your experience with school like? So if you can just share, you know, maybe some of like the highs and some of like the challenges that you found.
Not many challenges.
That's great.
Not really challenges. Again, I did my research. I specifically chose a school that had a DSP unit, so a designated specialist
provision.
There we go. Whilst he wasn't in that provision, even though I could have applied for it because he had his diagnosis, I wanted to try what he would be like in the mainstream school. But I just wanted him to be in a school that understood more about autism. Mm. When I went and viewed the school, I went in there with my iPad, my 21 questions, and I grilled that head teacher. Yeah. And I was very satisfied with the way that she answered the questions. And for me, the fish rots from the head. I honestly believe if I don't get a good vibe from the head teacher, I don't care the rest of the school. I don't care about it. That if that head teacher doesn't know what's going on, if that head teacher can't answer questions, if they're not involved, I'm sorry, it's a no for me. So I went to quite a few schools who I would ask the head teacher the same list of 21 questions, and they'll be fumbling. Mm. I will never send my child there. Never. So we did the groundwork in terms of the school. We worked together quite a lot. So during just before the 6 weeks holiday, so that transition between nursery and school, the Senko actually came to see Ezekiel in nursery, just to, you know, get a full picture of him and what he's like in that kind of setting. They made a book for him saying that, This is your school, this is your teacher, this is where the toilet is, all of that. So we could literally build that picture in his mind and start trying to incorporate, you know, that routine into his head. Throughout the summer holidays, I was taking him on the route.
Yeah.
We'll jump in a car. Hey, Ezekiel, we're going to your school. This is your gate. This is where we're going to go. We do that quite a few times just so he was like understanding and ready. So by the time it was, you know, first week, second week, he kind of really just fit in.
Yeah. That's amazing. That's amazing to hear. And you know, just to go back to even the questions, and I'm thinking back at, you know, when I was ahead of year, that was the kind of parents that I would love to engage with.
Mm.
You know, parents that are locked in and you're like, yeah, if this is how you are now, like, you're just going to keep being that parent who's part of that journey, you know, with the child and the school. And it's important to show that intentionality, that you care, that you're doing, you know, the research. And because a lot of parents is, oh, what's their Ofsted rating?
Mm.
Oh, my cousin's daughter went to that school 7 years ago. Or I went to that. Like, you're not doing, like what is it about the school? Like, what is it? What do you want your child to learn from the school?
Mm.
Not just in terms of, like, the curriculum, but beyond the curriculum. What are their values?
Yeah.
What's, you know, their extracurricular activities?
How big is the school?
Like, what's, like, the playground like? If there's someone that is active and they need to be moving around, you need to consider, you know, all of these things, which is important.
Mm.
So one of the things that I'm aware of, so in my role, again, I mentioned that I work closely with multi-agency, and I know when a child gets diagnosed, for example, with ADHD, and I believe it might be the same for autism, I'm not too sure, CAMHS would send like a care plan to the school and to the parents.
Mm.
But that care plan is generic. It gets sent for everyone that has ADHD. Like, this is your diagnosis. These are the things that school can be doing. It's generic, and it's not tailored to, you know, the child. It's just like, these are generic traits of ADHD, and these are things that, you know, as parents you can be doing at home, you know, school can be doing at things that school can be doing when the child's at school. Like, when you're in meetings with like educators and practitioners, etc., whether it's annual review meetings or whatever else, like, how do you advocate for like your child's needs?
Mm.
Like, knowing, okay, they've got autism, but not every child with autism is the same. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you advocate for his needs?
So Ezekiel's educational health and care plan isn't a generic one.
Okay.
Because you best believe Ezekiel went into school with his educational health and care plan. He, like, from nursery, we were sorting that, because I don't want to hear any stories when I get to school.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear it. And also, I think I was really lucky and blessed, should I say, with the pediatrician that we had, because she was like, you need to, before any kind of diagnosis, you need to be applying for this, because he's about to go to school.
Mm.
So don't wait for school and then start applying for the EHCP. I would suggest you do that now. So we were gathering all the data, gathering all the information, and then he saw a educational psychologist, came to see him at the nursery. We had to push for that, but it's really what the educational psychologist says, because obviously they're the ones that can say, oh, they need this, like, and tailor it to what they see about the child in front of them when it comes to autism anyways. So I pushed really, really hard for that. Speech and language was also on there. He had to go and do not an assessment, but like, we had to go and see doctors and stuff. So his one is actually quite tailored. I'm not sure how other people might do theirs, but his one is quite like for him, when they in terms of like attention bucket, when he should be having it, what should be on his desk, where his desk should be. Like, it was quite detailed, and I made sure of that. I don't play with that stuff.
Yeah.
So I've actually got an annual review meeting coming up next, just after half term, with Ezekiel. And what I will do is, thank goodness we've got a few years worth of like EHCPs to look back on, but also I have quite a lot of regular check-ins with the Senko, with the teacher. I do a lot with Ezekiel myself at home, so I can see like, okay, these are the things that he's good at, these are the things he might need help with, what are you seeing? In terms of last year, this is where he was. Do you think this needs to stay? Do we need to add anything else? And anybody that, you know, needs to be involved should be involved. So whether, do we need to call an educational health and educational health, do we need to call a psychologist to come and review him again, or is this something that we can do in-house, or, you know, that kind of thing. We also managed to get him a TA on there, a full-time TA for him, so he does have that in school. So
he gets the full funding then?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, level five. I told you I'm not playing.
Yeah, you said level five straight.
I told you I'm not playing. Yeah. Because at the time when Ezekiel started school, he was completely non-verbal and he was still in nappies.
Is he got some reception. Verbal capacity, you know? Like,
oh, absolutely. Oh, Ezekiel will tell you about yourself.
Yeah, he'll tell you.
Oh, yeah, he'll definitely say very, very direct. Which I'm finding a bit like, calm down. Yeah. But it's just the nature, isn't it? It's just the nature of...
Does he contribute to his, like, plan in terms of...
I think this year he might be able to, you know.
That's amazing.
Not going to lie, he might be able to. Maybe not last year. The speech was there, but I think the true deep meaning and understanding of stuff maybe wasn't. You could ask Ez, how are you? And say, oh, I'm fine.
Yeah.
And the conversation might not have gone further than that. But now... That's a whole year. A lot can happen in a year.
Yeah.
And what we're finding with his speech is a lot more spontaneous now.
Yeah.
And he can tell you about his feelings. He can tell you about what he's thinking. So I'm definitely going to try and implement getting his point of view across in there as well. Because there's always a section that I have to leave blank because I can't really ask him about it. So this year.
It won't be blank for much longer anyway. Yeah. So that's good. So I wanted to ask as well, so on this journey, have there been any like groups or people or resources that have been like very helpful for you? Because I know you said earlier that, you know, you sort of started the journey not really knowing much about, you know, autism. So it would be good to know, especially for, you know, our listeners or people that might be on the same journey or starting off new? Like, who, aside from yourself, obviously, you know, but who were like you leaning on, and who were your resources?
I feel like there's a lot more. You have to remember, like, this as a seven. So we're talking 5 years ago. There was not a lot out there. Oh, well. There really wasn't a lot out there. And I'm just grateful for the fact that there are resources now. There's one lady I have to big up, and I always talk to her, talk about her. Wemsey, her name is Wemsey, and she runs a page called Aquotas, and she's got three autistic children. And when I first came across her YouTube channel, she was talking about, you know, the signs of autism in her child and just her experience as a, you know, Black Nigerian woman in the UK with an autistic child. And then at the time, I think the other children she had, she thought that they might be autistic, and now they do have all of the diagnoses for all three of them. But I guess it was just, I was looking for a video of how to potty train, because, as I said, as until about five was still in nappies. So it was hard. So I was looking for, like, how to potty train, and I came across her page, and I was just like, wow, representation. Because you type in autism, at the time, you weren't seeing no Black families or Black children. It was all white middle class. And to me, I found that quite astonishing and strange, because actually the prevalence of autism is higher in Black children. Like, statistically higher. So I was like, where are we? And I guess that's part of why I do what I do as well, because I don't want somebody to be like, oh my God, like, there's no representation. There's nobody that looks like my child. There's nobody that looks like me. So yeah, that's why I started sharing a lot of our journey as well. But yeah, she was very, very instrumental in those early days of, you know, trying to feel seen and feel heard. Now there's a few more. There's Black SEN mamas who I know are doing some great work.
I know them.
With
them online. Yeah,
they're doing some really, really good work, and a few others which I can't remember off the top of my head. There's Kevin Antola. Kevin's a bit older. I think he's like 18 or 19 now, and she shares his journey, and I feel like that's nice to see. You know, I can imagine Ez in like 10 years time, what's he going to look like? What's it going to be? How, you know, potentially. So it's nice to have that kind of representation and that it's almost like online support almost, because where are we in these spaces?
That's amazing. And I know, you know, as a follow on from that, you do some amazing work as well with learning with Ez. It would be good to know sort of what inspired that, and also like how has it been received from, like, you know, parents, like educators or people in the community? Like, what's some of the impact that you're observing already from that?
Oh yeah. So learning with Ez is my baby. That started because I was doing things like PECS, which is picture exchange communication system. And just some of the like flashcards I was trying to use. They weren't representative. They weren't of Black children. They were all blonde hair, blue eyes. And I know that ain't my child. Do you know what I mean? But also, a lot of autistic people are very visual in their nature. So if I'm showing him a card that doesn't look like him, he's not going to know that I'm talking about him, that I'm referencing him. So I created Learning with Ez and Friends. That's the full name. And it's just some flashcards to represent Ez and his friends, literally, because it was all his friends at the time. Well, they still are his friends. But I wanted to, at the time, he wasn't verbal. So I wanted it almost to be like, oh, are you hungry? Are you tired? You know, just something that he could use to kind of tell me how he was feeling. From there, I just thought, okay, I think I'm onto something. And I created these flashcards and started, you know, putting it out there, and it was so well received. So well received by teachers, by parents, schools, because I remember a girl who said she worked in a special school in like Peckham or something, and she was like, yeah, all the children here are Black and all of the resources are white. So thank you for this. And I was like, yeah, there's such a disconnect there.
Yeah.
And it's really sad that our children are underserved.
100%. Are you still doing the cards?
I am. I had to take a break last year due to health issues, I'll be completely honest. You know, when you do too much, because of all the other work I do, I was just taking on a lot. So I did take a break, but we're looking to the relaunch in the next, like, hopefully by summer.
From your experience, what kind of support do you think is most, that parents lack the most or struggle to get, especially like around SEND? What do you think, like, parents struggle with?
All of it.
Wow.
All of it. Definitely all of it. Because it's almost like you're just given, once you can even get to that point of a diagnosis, you're just given the diagnosis, off you pop. You might have maybe a leaflet or two, but that's it. Unless you're proactive, unless you're doing the research yourself, unless you're that parent that's like, you know, I need to know what's available. Because I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like they hide things on purpose because they are very, very overstretched. And I understand that, right? But there's certain things they don't make public knowledge as such. Like, you have to have an in, or you have to know somebody that knows these rules or what's available to you. Mm. Because I feel like the amount of parents that are now trying to advocate for their children, I don't think autism is on the rise. I just feel like parents have a little bit more knowledge, thank you to social media. Mm. It's a huge issue. It's a huge issue. They don't tell you what's available. So, like, for instance, I didn't know that I could have been assigned a special needs social worker specifically for Ez, not because of there's, like, issues in the home or whatever, but that social worker could have now helped to advocate for X, Y, and Z for him, or, like, on the educational health and care plan, that section about direct payments. They tend to just brush past it, but actually everybody is entitled to get some of those direct payments to them. But the way the language around it, if you don't quite understand it and they're not telling you either, you're not getting that piece of that money that's actually they're entitled to. You know? DLA, disability living allowance, like, little things, like, if you do it online versus if you call. If you call them and they send you the paper form, it'll be stamped. Therefore, when you do send it in, it'll be backdated. Yeah. Versus if you just do it online, they just start it from the date. Little things like that. Little things like that, they just don't tell you. But unless you're in the know, or unless you're in these groups, or unless you have someone that's in the inside, you're never going to know.
And that's why like advocacy is important, and that's why a community is important as well. When, you know, I say time and time again, you know, even like this platform here, like I've created a community where people are locking in, not just for like specific like episodes, but they know actually this is a platform where I can learn. So someone might listen to this, might not have a child who has needs, but might know someone, and they'll be like, yo, like, make sure you go and do, you know, X, Y, and Z. So, you know, advocacy and community is important. And speaking of, you know, of that, I know you do Mums and Teas, Mums and Tea. You fostered this, you know, amazing community where, you know, black mothers, you know, come together, and, you know, you empower each other with knowledge and support, etc. Like, how important has that community been to you, and like what's the importance of like representation as well, you know, when thinking about that community and thinking about the impact of the wider advocacy that you're given?
I'd be nowhere without that community. I'm not going to lie to you. Especially in those early days when you're a first-time mom, you don't really... Okay, so in my instance, I was the first one out of my friends, as you know, like my close circle of friends, to get married and have a baby. I was literally the first one. There was nobody else. Like, The next person to have a child in my circle was like, I think the oldest is like 2.
Mm. Yeah.
So for the longest time, it was literally just me. And going out and seeking that community for myself, but also for other people, because I was like, if I'm alone, then so many other people must also feel alone. And there's too many of us to feel alone. So I wanted that interconnection, like between people. And obviously my background is psychology, HR, I'm a people's person by nature.
Yeah.
So I feel like if not for that community, I probably wouldn't have been able to make it. I probably wouldn't have been able to like feel strong in that advocacy piece, because maybe somebody in the group is a social worker, or somebody in the group is a teacher, or somebody in the group, do you know what I mean? And then we all share our experiences and our stories and what best practices are and stuff like that. So that definitely helped within the advocacy journey, because it's being with other Black mums who get it. And that's important. I'm not saying like if you're, oh, those white mums, oh, those Facebook groups. No. Don't get twisted. They do their thing. But you have to remember, I'm raising a Black man.
Mm.
So my experience of parenting will be, there's certain totally nuances that'll be very, very different. So it's just nice to be in those safe spaces where you feel like, yeah, I can talk and I can be myself and people will just be able to understand.
Yeah. And in those spaces, like, do you ever have parents who like are still struggling to understand or accept like the neurodiversity or the disability, you know, within their child, and how do you support them with that? Because it's not, like you said, it's, you know, one day you have a child, your child's growing up, and all of a sudden, boom, even if you have an inkling that, oh, you know what, something might, the diagnosis just changes it. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And that acceptance might be difficult, you know, for parents. Like, how do you support those parents that yes, they're trying, they're in the group, but it's still difficult, they still can't accept it?
Mm-hmm. I feel like you said, deep down they know. So I think for me, if I do get a parent like that maybe is like, you can see there might be a little bit of resistance or whatever, I feel like if you're here and you're talking to me, or you're reaching out to me, or you're sending me a DM, you know you want the help. So then it's my job to help them see autism is not a bad thing.
Yeah.
It's my job to help use Ezekiel as an example of, yo, like, my son is autistic and I love him down. I love him bad. I'm not saying you don't love your child, but regardless of if he's autistic or not, that's me, right? Yeah. When you see him, you see me. And I remember one time I was at an event and one lady was like, she made me cry, and I'm going to try not to cry. She was saying to me that she had a feeling her daughter was autistic, and she was finding it quite difficult. But when she found my page and she saw how I was loving on my son regardless, how I was putting into him, she said it really helped her change her mind and shift her perspective about autism. That if this mum can do this for this child, what am I doing for mine? And she'd been following me for years. And the first time she came to Mums and Tea, she just hugged me and burst out crying. Like, yo, like, you've been helping me and you didn't even know. Yeah. And you've changed my perception of autism just by the way you are raising your child.
Yeah. That's amazing. That's a powerful testimony. And you know, you become a voice for others. And it'll be interesting to know like what sparked this sense of empowerment, because you could have just kept it in house. You could have kept loving on your son in house. Like, what was it for you that was like, you know what, this needs to be amplified, what I'm doing here needs to be seen, you know, through wider lenses, so people can really, you know, see what's going on here.
What's going on? Again, I just felt like, because I was at the time, you got 6-5 years ago, there was no representation online. None. And where are we all hanging out now? It's online. You look online, you're searching what is autism, what are best practices, all of that. A lot of it is, you know, word of mouth and conversations and stuff, but most of us are glued to our phones. Mm-hmm. If we're not on TikTok, we're on Instagram. If we're not on Instagram, we're searching the internet. You know, we're on Google. So for me, that level of representation not being there, I was like, nah, something has to change.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Something has to change. It's either I'm a part of the change or we do something about it. But I just felt like I don't want anybody else to come up empty when they're searching. You type in autism, you see a white kid. That alone is a barrier. If you're searching for representation and you're not finding it there, then you're going to think it's not for you. You think of why a lot of people don't like are rejecting like neurodiversity and all of that. It's because if they look for it, they're not finding themselves. So they're not going to make that connection as to, oh, this is also for us and our community, because I'm just seeing white middle class children and families and boys.
Yeah. No, it's difficult. It's difficult. And you know, sort of moving on from that somewhat, you know, you've shared a lot about, you know, all the amazing things that you've done for Ez and you've poured into him. And I think even for me as well, being a parent, and I'm sure you can attest to this, you know, we learn so much from, you know, our child, you know, and our children. And I think for me, it would be good to know, like, what has Ez taught you about, like, strength, about resilience, about, you know, love, you know, on the journey that, you know, you've been on with him?
I wrote an article about this actually once for HuffPost. And when I was writing it, I was crying. I was crying. I was like, this boy, this is too much for me. I think one of the biggest things I can actually say, Ezekiel showed me that love doesn't need any words.
That's powerful.
Yeah. Because, again, for the longest time, he was completely nonverbal. But he knew that I loved him. And I knew that he absolutely loved me too. No words. Just actions.
Yeah. That's powerful, man. But we could end it there, man.
Mic drop.
We could end it there, man. That's powerful. I might just make this whole episode just that 30 seconds. Like, this whole episode, just like, this is the episode, 30 seconds, bam. But yeah, no, that was powerful, man. And as we sort of near to the end, it'll be good to know as well. Like, if you had, like, there's so many things for people to consider when sort of navigating, like, send the community, schools, parenting. If you had, like, top three advice that you would give to parents around, you know, navigating that send journey, parenting or with schools or whatever, like, what would your top three advice be?
Know your rights. Know your rights. Know what you're entitled to. And you're going to have to dig deep. Mm. You're going to have to do a lot of research. But thank God, you guys have got ChatGPT now. There was no ChatGPT 5 years ago. That's a new thing. That's come up in the last 1 to 2 years.
Mm.
So your life has actually even been made easier in terms of doing your research and what's specific to you in your borough.
Mm.
Mind you, by the way, make sure that it's borough specific. Otherwise, if you can't be searching for stuff in Hackney, if you live in Lewisham, it might be totally different.
Yeah.
So, like, make sure that you know your rights. You know what your child is entitled to. Look on the local, your borough's local offer. See what's available. See what's out there. I think it's really important because there's a certain, like, pots of money that's available. There's certain like programs, certain courses, maybe. Certain things, you don't know what you don't know, especially in this world. If it's new to you, you're gonna wanna, you know, do your research. It almost, I guess, it wasn't new to me as such. I had, although the majority of my career is in HR, I had a brief stint of working as a TA in a school.
Oh, wow.
In a DSP.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I knew about EHCPs. I'd worked with autistic children. And I had a little bit of an idea, 3 months worth, but still better than the, you know, the layperson who probably hasn't ever worked in a school, stepped foot in a school. So I knew what some of these terms were. very loosely, but, you know, so I was able to build on that. But if not, I would be, a lot of the stuff I did have to start from scratch. And you do, yeah, research. In a world where they're not trying to tell you these things, you really have to have your wits about you. I'd say the second thing probably would be, there's a lot that's coming to mind. The second thing would probably be, don't make enemies. Don't make enemies. We know what the stereotypes are. Strong, loud, angry black woman, parent, dad, whatever it may be. You're already coming up against certain things, right? And how we move and how we navigate through the world is different to other people.
Of course.
So coupled with the fact that, you know, it's not about you, it's about your child, I would say, when it comes to the schools, when it comes to the councils, if you've done your research, you don't need to come on this angry tip, because you can just hit them with the facts. You can hit them with the, oh, I've seen that my EACP has taken longer than it should. Should I be taking you guys to court? But in a nice way, you know, you don't have to come on this aggressive thing. And yes, it's frustrating. You get angry. There are moments where you might have to just let it rip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But don't lead with that. Ultimately, the schools, and they should want the best for your child also. And if not, then you maybe have to rethink, you know, the place of setting of education. But I would say, because it's already a fight. Everything I've said already, it's already a fight to get to these places, to get some of these things. It's a fight. Then you're coming to fight the school as well. You're coming to, like, don't make enemies. That's it. It's a hard world. But if you at least lead with peace and understanding, but show them, listen, it's not me you're gonna play with. It's neither my child.
Yeah.
Let them know you have your wits about you, kind of thing. So it's a delicate balance, but yeah, like, get that part right. I would say an example for me is with Ez's school, last year we had a teacher that maybe wasn't that great. Maybe she wasn't. I'll just be completely honest. So I'm coming into the meetings like, okay, has this been done? It wasn't been done.
Well,
there was no one-to-one. There was no, like, all these things. And it was a stern conversation we had to have. That, look, this is what the EHCP says, and this is what's not being done. Mm. What's going to be done about it? I'm not coming with a, yo, Nah.
Yeah.
This is on paper. This is what's supposed to be happening. And I understand funding, whatever. But my child can't be failing because of your inadequacies. So what are we going to do about it? How can we work together? You know, those kind of conversations. Because, just have to show them that you're just a very well-invested parent.
Yeah.
And the third, you don't have to do this alone. There's a lot of resources. There's a lot of groups. There's a lot of things out there to make sure that you're supported.
Yeah.
Take time out for yourself as well. Like, literally, the respite is a thing. Yeah. Like, even you can get respite through the council, like, because it can get on top.
Yeah.
So make use of all of the resources around you, your family, your friends. And just know, you were never built to do this alone. You should never have to go through this alone.
Yeah. Now, that's important. Thank you. Like, amazing advice. I know earlier you spoke briefly and you mentioned that, you know, you took some time out last year to focus on your health and not to dive into that specifically. But in terms of parenting, in terms of, like, your advocacy work, your project with, like, Mums and Tea, Life with Ez and Friends, like, all of these, like, projects, like, how and what do you do to sort of manage, like, your mental health and well-being whilst juggling all of these things?
It's been a journey. It's definitely been a journey. I've had to get therapy because it was just getting too much for me. And I just felt like, I can do it all, I can do it all. Oh, I don't need help. No. I crashed and burned. And then my health went with it too. Yeah. My health went with it too, because as you're thinking, stuff is happening in your body as well. Do you know what I mean?
Deteriorating, isn't
exactly. So yeah, not to delve into like exactly what happened, but like high blood pressure is real, especially in our community. But I should not be experiencing that at 32.
Yeah.
Do you get what I'm saying? So like, and a few other conditions that was coming up as well at the time related to stress, because I'm not taking the time out. I'm not putting myself first. As much as yes, it's about my husband, my children, my family, my immediate family, my work. What's gonna happen if I'm not here? I will run myself into the ground, and then I'm not able to do the stuff that I've been called to do. It doesn't make sense.
Mm.
So yeah, that's why I had to really think about, okay, cool, like what am I doing right now? What can I maybe take a step back from? And when I'm feeling better mentally, physically, I'm able to come back to. Yeah. So that's why I had to take that break.
No, that's important. That's important. And thank you for sharing. Earlier this year, you did a TED Talk. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And in the TED Talk, you were championing and speaking about Black maternal health. And as a result of that, I think, maybe not as a result of the TED Talk, but leading up to that, there was the inception of, is it called Five Times More?
Yeah, Five Times More.
Five Times More. What's been the impact of Five Times More, and what was just like the general experience of, you know, like just doing the talk?
So Five Times More has been running for the last 6 years. We're in our sixth year. That's been a journey and a half. We started in 2019. When I was pregnant with my second child, because the experience giving birth to Ez wasn't a pleasant one at all. And when I fell pregnant again, I was like, this can't happen again. Yeah. Sorry, this, no. So I wanted to do, initially it was supposed to be a one-off event just to like raise awareness and that kind of thing. But God had other plans. Yeah. So we've done a number of things. I would say we're like the leading organisation in the UK dedicated to improving Black maternal health outcomes. And a TED Talk happened in January. But before that, we've been instrumental in Parliament, trying to get the MPs and the government to make changes, as well as resources for women, like free resources for women. We've got an app, we've got like a really good website. Like we're just, again, because that was out of a need of, I don't want people to go through what I was going through. So to make sure that they have what they need to safely be able to advocate for themselves. And then we train health professionals within the NHS. And also we conduct research and produce reports. So yeah, over the years we've done a number of different things to like try and improve, you know, the outcomes for women and that kind of thing. So yeah, we were approached to do the TED Talk. A lot of people have to apply, but we were actually approached. And when I say this thing is a God-given mission, certain opportunities that have come, we're just like, yo, how? But it's all him, literally all him. Mo Gilligan, you know Mo the comedian, at one point he donated his fee for the Brits to our organisation. Yeah, amazing. Because he had seen the great work we were doing and he was just, you know, so moved by it. And yeah, like he donated his fee to us and he's been so supportive, you know, since then. So many different things. We've been on TV, CNN, British Vogue, you name it. Like we've been there.
And that's just the beginning.
Yes.
The beginning of the journey.
Amen. The TED Talk. For me, I'm like, the TED Talk is the beginning.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Aside of all of that. But yeah, the run up to the TED Talk was intense.
Mm.
I'm a yapper, I'm a talker.
Yeah.
But my co-founder is more of a behind the scenes kind of girl. She's not really the type of like trying to be in front of the camera like that. It's just not her thing. So she it pushed her. It pushed me too, yeah. Because they say we don't read from scripts or any, we don't read from like teleprompters. You have to internalize it, they say. So yeah, like that was intense. I didn't realize it would take so much out of me.
Yeah.
But so, just thank God for it, because it's there now. Yeah. TEDx London, like, it's a big deal.
Yeah.
They only choose 10 people a year to give a TED talk in London. So
and you were one of the 10. You did it.
One of the 10.
Well done. Well done. And just to finish off with, as we round up, if you can go back to the start of your journey,
mm-hmm.
and give, you know, younger you some advice, just one piece of advice or one piece of reflection or one thing to just hold on to, like, what would that be?
How young?
At the start of your journey, this journey with Ez. We're not talking like younger you, you know, sixth form school days. Yeah. We was all out here. We don't want that advice at the start of your journey with
Okay.
Ez.
At the start of my journey with Ez, that's a good question, actually, because I'm really having to think, what would I say to myself? Because I didn't do it perfectly. As much as I'm coming on here and saying, yeah, I did this. Mm. It wasn't all perfect. I think what I have to say about that is probably,
it's a difficult one, isn't it?
It is quite hard. Yeah. I'm really, really thinking. What would I say to myself 6 years ago? Trust your gut.
Trust your gut. Yeah, that's important.
Trust your gut. If you're getting a vibe, something is off.
It's off. Yeah. You get the feeling it's off?
It's off.
The gut's never led us wrong.
Yeah. Trust your gut. And in that, you know, if you need to remove yourself, protect your peace, whatever it may be, do that.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
that's amazing. Thank you. And, you know, before we finish off, I just wanted to sort of give you your flowers. Like, honestly, like the work that, you know, you're doing, like the advocacy, like your journey has just been, you know, amazing. And just for context, for those who don't know, we went uni
UKC.
Together. UKC. So big up all the UKC guys. And it's been what?
Gosh.
13 years? No. Even longer, 2009. So you started in 2010.
Yeah.
So it's been like 14, 15 years. Yeah.
Crazy.
15 years.
Crazy.
And, you know, it's like even beyond us, like, it's always amazing to see like the wider friendship group just going on to do, you know, amazing things in their individual spaces. But often we don't get, you know, a chance to sort of give each other like their flowers. But anytime I see you, you know, posting something or doing something, I'm just rooting. I'm just like, oh yeah, like, this is amazing. And no one could have foreseen that. The majority of us, like, our journeys, like, no one could have foreseen it when it was like 2010, 2011, because the focus was like different. So like, to fast forward 14, 15 years on, and, you know, us being here as like, you know, parents, advocates, and, you know, excelling in all of our different spaces is just amazing to see. And keep it up. I'm looking forward to the next TED Talk, which will hopefully be a global one.
Amen.
Europe and America and whatever else. So, you know, thank you again for coming on.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for all the work you do as well. I know you're doing great stuff in your field. So yeah, keep going.
Thank you very much. So that has been the Too Cool for School podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, like, subscribe and share and follow us on all of our social media platforms. Thank you.